The title of my talk is Male and Female Novels, Gendered Fictions and the Reading Public 1770 to 1830. Introduction. The person, be it gentleman or lady, who has not pleasure in a good novel must be intolerably stupid. So asserts Henry Tilney, the hero of Northanger Abbey, Jane Austen's spoof of Regency fiction written in 1818, published in 1818. Tilney is striking a sensible medium between the two extremes that were crudely correlated with gender by the end of the 18th century. Men, according to popular discourse, never read novels. Quote, "Oh Lord, not I. I never read novels. I have something else to do," blusters Austen's boorish John Thorpe, striking a masculine posture. He is exhibiting the male ideal defined by vigorous sportsmanship and disgust for feminine fictions with their minute details of conduct, morality, and love. Women, on the other extreme, were believed to read little else but novels. Mocking this cliché, Austen depicts the naive heroine, Catherine Morland, confessing that she can barely endure poetry, plays, and travels, and hates history because, quote, "the men are all so good for nothing, and there are hardly any women at all," unquote. Instead, she is addicted to Gothic novels. How real was this distinction between what men and women read? A minute later, Thorpe continues, quote, "Novels are also full of nonsense and stuff. There has not been a tolerably decent one come out since Tom Jones, except The Monk. I read that t'other day. But as for all the others, they are the stupidest things in creation. Except Mrs. Radcliffe's. Her novels are amusing enough. They are worth reading. Some fun and nature in them." Austen's joke is that Thorpe, and by extension men in general, actually do read novels, and not only those with roguish male heroes like Henry Fielding's Tom Jones, or lurid scenes of rape and corruption like Matthew Lewis's The Monk. In fact, men even read Gothic mysteries centred on persecuted women, like Anne Radcliffe's The Mysteries of Udolpho. Thorpe's remark sketches out the battle lines in the gendering of literary culture, whereas women read fantasy, stuff and nonsense. Men read fun and nature, tales about violence, adventure, and real life. In fact, John Thorpe and Catherine admire precisely the same books, Gothic romances set in the dark past, depicting sensitive heroes or heroines, mystified by traces of bloodshed and ghostly noises, and besieged by tyrannical murderers in remote castles. These novels exemplified cheap fiction for the audience at the turn of the 18th century and were publicly identified as women's novels because of their feminine heroines and plots and because of the places and ways they were read. In fact, the late 18th century was full of moralists panicking about who read, how and why they read, and especially what they read. Fiction became the flashpoint for gender anxieties because the novel was the central prominent signal and symptom of a changing society, because new kinds of novels focused on sexualized sensibility, and because of the rising female cultural presence. The novel had a tradition of evoking elite sneers dating from early in the 18th century. These novels were mainly adventure tales. Some star hyper-masculine heroes engaged in warfare, hazardous travel, and rambunctious behaviour. Others describe women beleaguered by hunger, desertion, greedy relatives, and lustful men. Tobias Smollett's rollicking tale of picaresque urban adventures and wartime exploits, The Adventures of Roderick Random, 1748, for example, was so popular that it ran through 18 English editions by 1800, not to mention the many foreign ones. At the same time, translations of novels rooted in 17th century continental romances were becoming increasingly widely read, despite or because they had been long associated with female depravity, particularly self-love and sexual profligacy. Even in the mid-18th century, female novelists attempted to dissociate themselves from such works. Notably, Charlotte Lennox's The Female Quixote, 1742, satirizes the novel-addicted Arabella for believing herself a princess in a romance. And in Roderick Random, Miss Williams blames her descent into prostitution on an addiction to romantic fiction that leads her to identify with novelistic heroines. Novels became a byword for insane or dangerous female rebellion because they were seen to encourage sexual passion. Even as early as 1741, in George Colman's satirical play Polly Polly Honeycomb, a dramatic novel, the heroine contradicts her parents, rejects housework, and resolves gleefully to dominate her future husband, since, addicted to novels, she has, quote, conquered fear and almost conquered shame, like all, quote, girls of reading and superior notions who from the fountain's head drink love's sweet potions. Although the well-read Polly is female, the novels she reads are written by both men and women, as the play's circulating catalogue of library catalogue shows. During the period from 1770 to 1830, the anxiety about women's reading peaked. This was partly because novels were perched uneasily at a crux of a storm of ideas about politics, education, gender roles, and social practices. When, in the 1790s, following the French Revolution, England experienced a fierce conservative backlash, novels came especially under attack because women's education sprang to the forefront of cultural concerns. This was prompted by Mary Wollstonecraft's A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, 1792. Her manifesto stressed the need for women's intellectual self-determination in place of the outdated accomplishments of music, painting, dancing, and embroidery. But Wollstonecraft herself was notorious for what people considered sexual promiscuity. Indeed, so anxious was the novelist Maria Edgeworth to prove the morality of her fiction and dissociate herself from Wollstonecraft that she prefaced her novel Belinda, 1801, by denying that it actually was a novel. I don't think people believed her. Quote, "Every author has a right to give what appellation he may think proper to his work. The public have also a right to accept or refuse the classification that is presented. The following work is offered to the public as a moral tale," the author not wishing to acknowledge a novel. "For so much folly, error, and vice are disseminated in books classed under this denomination that it is hoped the wish to assume another title will be attributed to feelings that are laudable and not fastidious." Edgeworth opposes morality to the very genre of the novel itself. Many heroines in didactic fiction also disdain novels and prefer works of poetry, morality, and history. In 1802, Lady Pennington, urging her daughters to read, declares, quote, "Novels and romances, very few of them are worth the trouble of reading. Some of them may, perhaps do, contain good morals, but they are not worth the finding where there is so much rubbish intermixed. They lead to errors of judgment, and I therefore advise you scarce ever to meddle with any of them." Yet the arguments that first, only women read novels at all, and yet secondly, that only bad women read novels, whereas good women read good works, particularly sermons, histories, poetry, and conduct manuals, was manifestly untrue. By defining her novel as a, quote, "moral tale," Edgeworth herself collapses the distinction between fictional tale-telling and morality, and reflects the fact that since so many women read novels, neither all the women nor all the novels could be bad. Moreover, new novels had been a central topic of fashionable conversation for half a century, and novel-reading women were becoming increasingly viable as cultural consumers. By the second decade of the 19th century, at the height of Romanticism, Sir Walter Scott's first novel, Waverley, or 'Tis 60 Years Since, 1814, grew so madly popular with both genders that it sold out its 1,000 copies in 5 weeks and appeared in 6 editions by the end of the year. Gender, nevertheless, remained a vital element in the construction, reception, and analysis of the form, and the issues it raises illuminate the development of the genre. Part 2. Quote, "By a lady," unquote, the gender of authors and aesthetics. What genders a novel? Is a female novel so defined because it is written by a lady, for ladies, or about ladies? Daniel Defoe's Moll Flanders, 1722, albeit written by a man, is certainly presented by a female narrator, and it is about a woman. But its tale of promiscuity and theft appealed as much to men as to women. So did his cautionary tale purportedly for women, Roxana, 1726, which chronicled its protagonist's descent into whoredom, murder, and madness. By the late 18th century, however, more women than ever were writing novels, and recent research has shown that they produced about a third of those published. From 1770 to 1800, novels identified in their title pages as by a female crested, as indeed did all novels, rising to 1,000 new fictions a year by 1800. Although most novels were still written by men, the prominence of the attribution by a lady indicates a shift in the relationship of gender to literature, particularly fiction. The advertisement, by a lady, shows that gender was becoming an aesthetic or formal aspect of fiction writing, a matter not of the author's sex, but of the books. Books that centred on women's lives were not necessarily woman-authored, but they were perceived as probably so. On reading Austen's Pride and Prejudice, Annabella Milbank, the future Lady Byron, speculated that it might have been written by Charlotte Smith, author of the popular Emmeline, 1789, commenting to her mother, quote, "I wish much to know who is the author or authoress, I am told." Fiction by a lady constituted only a part of the novels on offer. Many authors of both genders remained anonymous, at least in their first efforts. Of the 1,421 novels published between 1770 and 1799, the vast majority lacked any authorial attribution, no less than 71.3%, since, as William St. Clair has pointed out, anonymity both intensified the reader's curiosity and protected authors and publishers from any legal redress demanded by satirized high society figures. Critical reviews also paid specific attention to whether novels were suitable female fare, and in effect doomed any deemed too racy for the ladies. However, reviews of women's fiction eventually helped to elevate the status of women authors as writers equal to men. And in her important theorization of the novel, The Progress of Romance, 1778, Clara Reeve defends the genre itself against masculine contempt. Quote, "The learned men of our own country have in general affected a contempt for that kind of writing, and looked upon romances as proper furniture only for a lady's library." But in fact, she argues, they are equivalent to epic poems, the most prestigious literary form. Women authors were still a relatively new phenomenon in the late 18th century. While women like Aphra Behn, since the 17th century, had, of course, published, female publication was strongly associated still with public females, that is, prostitutes. Such a stigma prohibited many women from confessing their authorship, and doubtless dissuaded others from writing at all. Moreover, Behn herself was famous for her sexual liaisons, and since Defoe's Moll Flanders, novels recounting female experience, supposedly from a woman's pen, seemed guaranteed to supply sexual anecdotes, particularly since female narratives, by definition, relate the experience of femininity, that is, sexual or at least romantic experience. The term lady, however, carries not only gender but also class associations that help to soften the sexual innuendo of feminine authorship into a rather mistier sentimentalism. Jane Austen uses this designation, and contemporary readers, as she gleefully noted, verified her class signature by pointing out the writer's intimate knowledge of genteel social manners. Her first public fiction, Sense and Sensibility, was advertised in The Star, 31st October, and The Morning Chronicle, 7th, 9th and 28th of November, as written by a lady, by Lady A, or by Lady Dash. In contrast, Moll Flanders is no lady, nor is John Cleland's joyously promiscuous Fanny Hill, the narrator of Memoirs of a Woman of Pleasure, 1749. The term lady, rather than woman, hints that the author knows scandalous stories about high life, but has concealed her name in order to write more candidly, that is, more about the misdeeds of the mighty. This implication dates at least from de la Riviere Manley's Roman à Clef, satirising sexual corruption in the Whiggish nobility, The New Atlantis, 1709. But it was probably Eliza Haywood's erotic tales of female desire, particularly Love in Excess, 1720, that solidified the association of novels and female sexual experience. Indeed, the very notion of an autobiographical tale by a lady implies sexual scandal, since no lady worthy of the name would have any tale to tell. Her story ought to be, quote, a blank, my lord, as the virtuous Viola declares to her Orsino in Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. Furthermore, since many of the romantic novels ascribed to a lady use an epistolary format, they imply that they have an autobiographical basis and thus intensify the identification of female-authored fiction with stories of women's sexual feelings. Promising both sentimental titillation and the heady aroma of high cloth, the designation of by a lady promised readers female, fashionable and exciting feeling. Novels' gender ascription thus also advertised their form. Female-identified novels suggested not merely a sexual subject, but a structure that would reflect the unedited and spontaneous feelings and reflections of private writing, journals, and letters. Both of the most important precursors of sentimental fiction used private writing as their structure, albeit both were written by men. Samuel Richardson's Pamela, or Virtue Rewarded, 1740, partly constitutes the letters of an innocent and exemplary young woman to her parents, as she is besieged by her amorous guardian, Mr. B. But the novel also includes a large number of journal entries, supposedly written entirely for herself and thus artlessly unselfconscious. Lawrence Stern composes his immensely popular 9-volume sentimental fiction, The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy, 1759-68, as the first-person narrative of his troubled protagonist. Tristram, writing to intimate readers conjured in his mind. Opening with the instant of the interrupted orgasm that gave Tristram life, Tristram's spiralling stream-of-consciousness narrative enacts the novel's very plot by recording Tristram's sexual and emotional dysfunctionality, manifested by the circling writing itself. The unconventionality of this structure and the sexually explicit topic made Stern notorious in a way that only a man could live down or live with. Both in form and topic, women had perforce to be more conventional in order to preserve their authority. Stern's novel, however, provided the model for Henry Mackenzie's Man of Feeling, 1771, which features a young man so sensitive that he expires of a suppressed love that has mutated into physical disease. Although the protagonist is a man, the novel becomes a byword for the sort of sexually titillating fiction that women, especially young women, purportedly adored. The announcement of authorial gender implied this aesthetic technique of private writing. Since traditionally women were less well-educated than men, especially in the classical writers, they were perceived as writing in an informal way that was simpler, less elusive, and more spontaneous than a man's. Henry Tilney observes ironically, "It is their delightful habit of journalizing which largely contributes to form the easy style of writing for which ladies are so generally celebrated. Everybody allows that the talent of writing agreeable letters is particularly female." When Catherine doubts whether ladies write letters better than men, he asserts that their only faults are, quote, "a general deficiency of subject, a total inattention to stops," that is punctuation, "and a very frequent ignorance of grammar," unquote. Although artlessness was becoming fashionable for romantic poetry, women's weak education exposed them to charges of bad writing, charges cemented by their perceived preference for the derogated genre of the novel. Incorrectness or grammatical and usage errors were rare in published works, but the accusations of ignorance, simplistic characterizations, borrowed and stale plots, and stylistic ugliness remained, especially since women became associated with the generic, gothic, and romantic novels of circulating libraries. Although epistolarity spawned a slew of female-centered novels, by the 1770s, male protagonists were also manifesting sentimental delicacy. Tobias Smollett's most successful final novel, The Expedition of Humphrey Clinker, 1771, for example, constitutes correspondences between a group of characters, both men and women, but centres on the ruminative accounts of the prickly Matthew Bramble. Like Stern, Smollett chooses a male narrator with quirky sensibilities, using his epistolary form to recreate the privacy of intimate and uneducated communication. Nonetheless, perhaps partly because of Smollett's gender and the rambunctious masculine protagonist of his earlier work, reviewers perceive the book as broader and more significant than a fiction of feeling. They aver that its dramatization of regional manners gave it a geographical reach unattempted by most women novelists. In the anonymous review of Humphrey Clinker in the London magazine, Smollett is commended for providing fact rather than fancy. Instead of, quote, "much of the dreadful dangers, the surprising escapes, the deep distresses and the romantic passions which characterize our modern novel writers," the reviewer remarks, "Smollett's book provides something greatly preferable to a novel. It is pleasing, yet an important lesson on life. And that part of it which describes the Scotch nation is at once calculated to entertain the most gay and to give the most serious a very useful fund of information." However, later in the 1770s, sentimental novels increasingly featured women heroines and themes of female feeling. Sentimentalism was itself a broad philosophy that held that human instincts were naturally benevolent and that sympathy for fellow creatures demonstrated moral virtue. This translated in fiction into characters whose emotional responses to any acts of kindness or cruelty or violence and to scenes of beauty testified to their heroism. Indeed, sentimentalism promoted literature as an avenue for virtuous education through sympathetic feeling. This characterization seemed to fit women, since they were screened from the violence and machinations of war, politics, and public life. Yet, the treatment of sex still itself divided readers and genres. The more explicit the treatment, the less women were involved, as authors or presumably audiences. Some texts were supposedly forbidden to women, which does not mean that they did not read them. For example, the Duchess of Devonshire read Clodereux de Laclos' scandalous account of seduction, Les Liaisons Dangereuses, 1782, notorious in England for its immorality, although her husband edited it for her. And by the way, I'm also morally sure that Austen read it, because it seems such a very clear blueprint for Lady Susan. At the same time, sentimental heroes gradually changed gender. Such titles as Henry Brooke's Fool of Quality, 1766, and The Man of Feeling receded before a gush of those like Sophia Briscoe's Fine Lady, 1772, and Frances Burney's Evelina, or A Young Lady's Entrance into the World, 1778. And by 1816, 8 Julias and at least 4 Emmas had appeared. One better than all the others, I might add. Women's confined experience and delicate bodies, however, appear to allow them unique access to psychological depth. This particularly flourished in the subgenre of the female Gothic, which emphasized the uncertainties of perception that heroines suffer in an obscure, dangerous, patriarchal world. Anne Radcliffe's Gothics exemplify the genre by portraying heroines fleeing male violence or confined by tyrants, and entangled in murky plots featuring nefarious outlaws, madness, and murder. The suspense arises less, however, from the dramatic action than from the technique of representing the scenes entirely through the protagonist's consciousness. For example, when in The Mysteries of Udolpho, 1794, Emily St. Aubert's guardian, the ferocious Montoni, compels her to leave her aunt's house and accompany him to an obscure location, Radcliffe records not the causes, but Emily's speculations on them. After a terrified night, fearing Montoni means to murder her, quote, "it appeared, upon calmer consideration to Emily, that Montoni was removing her to his secluded castle because he could there, with more probability of success, attempt to terrify her into obedience. Or that, should its gloomy and sequestered scenes fail of this effect, her forced marriage with the Count could there be solemnized with secrecy." Never do we find out directly what his intentions are. We only know what she thinks and fears might happen. Radcliffe's plot unravels through the heroine's fears, confusions, and superstitions so that readers can never see clearly where the truth lies. Women's fiction also appeared more realistic. Scott himself remarked that, quote, "the women do the details of ordinary life better than men." And in his journal of the 14th of March, 1826, he noted, "Also read again, and for the third time at least, Miss Austen's very finely written novel of Pride and Prejudice. That young lady had a talent for describing the involvements and feelings and characters of ordinary life, which is to me the most wonderful I ever met with. The big bow wow strain I can do myself like anyone now going, but the exquisite touch which renders ordinary commonplace things and characters interesting from the truth of the description and the sentiment is denied to me. What a pity such a gifted creature died so early." Part three. Quote, "I never read novels," unquote. The gender of readers and reading. The fiction that only or mostly women read novels is also contradicted by the fact that most novel readers were male, as most readers always had been. By the mid-18th century, only about 60% of men and 40% of women could read at all. Also, works of religion, history, geography, and travel outstripped novels in most libraries, and although men had usually read more kinds of books than women, novel readers and library borrowers were still primarily male. However, if novels require less formal education and very little, if any, classical training to enjoy, they do take a long time to read, and women, at least upper and middle class women who are free from housework and less educated in traditional literature, had the leisure. I only wish my students did. Moreover, since far more women were reading and writing than ever before, and far more novels were tumbling off the press, women and novels seemed sisters in crime. In 1773, the Monthly Review sneered that women have always entertained, quote, "a keen relish for novels as they have for green apples or unwholesome food." Women figure as daughters of Eve, plucking the forbidden fruit and searching for sexual knowledge in fiction. Since novels were, by definition, new, they were fashion items, ephemeral and thus trivial. The Monthly Review remarks, quote, "Novels generally usher in the winter as snowdrops do the spring, and like them have little beauty to recommend them besides an early appearance," unquote. Novelty and transience were qualities associated with women. The proliferation of circulating fiction was seen to parallel the proliferation of female readers. Much of the anxiety concerning women reading resulted from where they read, places that appeared sequestered, improper, private, and fed a solitariness and secrecy that seemed to breed illegitimate fantasies. In adjuring his youthful female audience to self-improvement, the Reverend Henry Kett nervously declared, "Reading may be made a social as well as a solitary occupation." In fact, as book prices began abruptly to climb in the final quarter of the century, reaching 10 shillings and 6 pence for a typical three-volume novel, sharing reading matter became more common. Both circulating and private libraries were places of entertainment and display, with billiard tables, spinets, important paintings and card tables, and spaces for private and public reading. However, the circulating library most visibly stood as the emblem of unmonitored, excessive consumption of the ephemeral fiction demanded by female readers. If they chose the books publicly, they consumed them privately and obsessively. There were other venues for reading, coffee houses, shops, and private libraries, but some 75% of the run of a popular novel landed in a circulating library at some point. In fact, these institutions provided a huge range of texts to lenders from the city and countryside, but their signature stamp in the public consciousness was the three-decker novel. Despite the fact that most patrons were male, circulating libraries thus became identified with women's appetite for titillating reading. How people read also caused anxiety. Most important to romantic critics was the idea that by reading about heroines who defied convention to follow their hearts, female readers would rush into the arms of the nearest half-pay officer, of which there were many. This worry had to do with the notion that reading was an exercise in uncritical identification, that readers learned by imitation, just as they ought to learn Christian virtues by reading the Bible. Even Anna Letitia Barbauld, in her 50-volume edition of The British Novelists, 1810, needs to refute the charge that novels lead women astray, by admitting that although love forms the focus of most fiction, few readers believe it anything but fiction. Life, by contrast, is an indecipherable work in progress. While the model, the model of moral reading remained devotional, the medieval study of a few texts, the daily conning of the Bible, the memorization and contemplation of selected venerable works, the rush to read the newest novel required readers to speed through hundreds of pages. They seemed to read for the plot rather than the moral, the sentimental vignette rather than the intellectual conception, for the quick fix of feeling instead of the lesson of life. There were so many books that they thus seemed to demand extensive rather than intensive reading. Kett, for example, attempts to counter this tendency by telling young women to read attentively rather than gobbling up text the way they do novels. Give your mind to your author, he exhorts in italics, for if you read too hastily, you will learn nothing, and the ideas of the author will glide before your mind like the visions of a dream. Moreover, while men clearly also identified with heroes and indeed heroines, they were trained in scepticism, judgment, and restraint, whereas it was thought that women read corporeally and thus experienced the physical effects of sympathy, like blushing and fainting and desire. Fiction thus seemed to feed their anti-intellectual instincts. The novel appeared to embody a new and gendered way of consuming literary culture itself. 4. Conclusion. Longish. Novels in this period move from texts directed to both genders through an apparently mainly female period to another, perhaps gender-neutral stage. In the 1770s, epistolary sentimental fiction dominated. In the 1780s, it was female etiquette. The 1790s saw the Gothic. The 1800s and Regency featured conduct fiction. And from the mid-1810s on, it was romantic novels. But to readers from 1770 to 1830, individual novels also appeared to have, or at least hint at, a gender themselves. This identification of a text with a sex was manufactured from the combination of the gender of the heroes, their plots and settings, and their aesthetic. In short, interesting stories, that is, stories with a love interest, along with stories of familial relations, female roles, and women's behaviour, were now considered female. The supposed division between a male and a female book is particularly clear in the contrast between Jane Austen's Mansfield Park and Scott's Waverley, or 'Tis 60 Years Since, both published in 1814. Scott's novel, set in the previous century, relates the military, political, and romantic adventures of Edward, the heir of the Baronet St. Edward Waverley, after he leaves his family to join a regiment of dragoons bent on fighting the Jacobite rebellion in Scotland. Mansfield Park concerns the sufferings of a penniless heroine immured as a poor relation in the mansion of a grand family. In both novels, the heroes are distracted by inappropriate suitors, but find true love. And in both, a quarrel in the family, between brothers in Scott's case and sisters in Austen's, stimulate the complications of the plot. In the man's novel, however, the male hero leaves home and, despite misadventures, regains his honour and wins a pardon through military action. In the woman's, the heroine earns status and reward by self-discipline and passive resistance. In both manner and matter, Scott's novels go where women's fiction generally feared to tread. Whereas most women avoided stylistic crudity for fear of incorrectness, Scott gives his characters a Scottish dialect. Scott's fictions also sketch an historical past in accurate detail. The first reviewer emphasized Waverley's historical setting, declaring that, quote, "We are unwilling to consider this publication in the light of a common novel, whose fate it is to be devoured with rapidity for the day and afterwards forgotten forever, but as a vehicle of curious, accurate information upon a subject which must at all times demand our attention, the history and manners of a very, very large and thus renowned portion of the inhabitants of this island." Scott's use of the history thus also worked to gender his novels, since women's interest in history was perceived as light, given, as Catherine Morland points out, that it features so few women. A novel subgenre, Gothic, sentimental, conduct, now implied its gender, Scott himself contrasts his real history with the stale female fantasy version, and his originality with the formulaicism of circulating library fare. In the preface to Waverley, debating the book's title, he declares, "Had I, for example, announced in my frontispiece, 'Waverley, a tale of other days,' must not every novel reader have anticipated a castle, scarce less than that of Udolpho, of which the eastern wing has long been uninhabited, and the keys either lost or consigned to the care of some aged butler or housekeeper, whose trembling steps, about the middle of the second volume, were doomed to guide the hero or heroine to the ruinous precincts? Would not the owl have shrieked and the cricket cried on my very title page? Or, if I had rather chosen to call my work a sentimental tale, would not it have been a sufficient presage of a heroine with a profusion of auburn hair and a harp, the soft solace of her solitary hours, which she fortunately finds always a means of transporting from castle to cottage? Or, again, if my Waverley had been entitled A Tale of the Times, wouldst thou not, gentle reader, have demanded from me a dashing sketch of the fashionable world, a few anecdotes of private scandal, thinly veiled, and if lusciously painted, so much the better? A heroine from Grosvenor Square, and a hero from the Barouche Club, or the Four in Hand. But the object of my tale is a description of men, not manners. As a romantic regard for literary originality and the singularity of character and genius rose, genre fiction became stamped as conventional female entertainment. Nonetheless, male and female novels of the period share themes and plot lines. Foremost of these are the discovery of identity and the recovery of inheritance. In Smollett's Humphrey Clinker, the servant Humphrey is discovered miraculously to be the natural son of his irascible but tender-hearted master, Matthew Bramble. And all Radcliffe's novels, most of the Minerva Press formula fiction, indeed a huge number of other examples, all concern the heroine's recovery of her identity and fortune. Several women authors spin this plot with a particularly female twist of women's disenfranchisement. Austen's Sense and Sensibility concerns the Dashwood lady's disinheritance, and Ferrier's The Inheritance, 1824, also recounts the story of the aristocratic Gertrude St. Clair's disinheritance and consequent discovery of true love. However, by the 19th century, reading and readers of novels began to escape clear gender identification as the genre became part of the British literary heritage. Significantly, Barbauld's British Novelists, itself an emblem of the rise of the novel's prestige in the Romantic period, does not differentiate authors by gender or novels by subgenre. Elizabeth Inchbald, Charlotte Smith, Frances Burney, and Anne Radcliffe conclude the series, but her list includes French and German titles, satirical and historical fictions, even a Chinese novel, as well as the by-then canonical productions of Laurence Sterne, Henry Fielding, Samuel Richardson, Samuel Johnson, and a host of works now forgotten. Yet, it is worth remembering at the same time that Barbauld uses a new prominence of women writers to prove the genre's probity, its moral worth. She declares, defiantly, that, quote, "a very great proportion of good writers are ladies. And surely it will not be said that either taste or morals have been the losers by their taking the pen," unquote. I think at Chawton we can all agree.